From my basement on East 10th Street in the city that's a hill, Duluth, Minnesota, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development. I'm Ellen Burns-Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Stephen McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Mark McCroy. I, too, make nice games.
Yesterday, we worked all day on Robostin, and then we played it with my family. Oofta. Today, we're here to share how it went and what we learned. So, if everyone's ready, let's start.
That's got to be the most Minnesotan we've ever had it as an intro on the show. Oofda.
Oofda.
Setting the expectations early.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We're still at Ellen's. Mm-hmm. I'm enjoying this space as a recording space.
Yeah.
It's kind of nice.
It's nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a full dining table, but it's butted up against a couch. So yeah. It has like three sides.
That was my bed for the weekend.
Hey, you didn't complain about it.
No, it was nice, actually.
It feels kind of purpose-built, even though it's not. We got all our stuff set up.
And... Yeah.
We're talking about how this is a table that my dad made, and it's got these really long, like, edges that the mic clamps
perfectly on.
It's wonderful.
But, yeah, that's great.
Yeah. Luxurious basement.
If you're new to our Duluth adventure, last week we recorded from here as well, or rather 2 days ago from where we're sitting. It was great that Stephen and I can come up and visit Ellen, and we're still here. We're leaving right after the recording, pretty much, and we're going to take Ellen to the airport.
Yep.
That's really the whole reason we came up here, to give Ellen a ride back down to the airport.
Kind of expensive, but we like Ellen a lot. So.
We thought we'd get some episodes out of it.
Right. Thanks, guys.
But there was, of course, another precious resource up here, which was your family, who we got to playtest Robostin.
Yeah.
Like you said in the intro, all the work we did on it yesterday, we sort of culminated with forcing them to sit down, and all three of us were staring at all three of them as they read our rules.
Yep.
And we had our mouths shut the whole time, trying to just, they'll figure it out.
Yeah.
It
was rough. Yeah.
Yeah. This is a much more complex game than, Glom or Dogpile.
Yeah.
And my parents are in their 70s, and their idea of tabletop gaming is cribbage or poker. So it's not to say we've never played tabletop games with them, we do. We've made them play. But they're not really practiced at it, which made them perfect for testing newly refreshed rules. And so we all spent all day on various things. Stephen, you were working all day on putting together some new objectives or refreshing and revising some other ones we were working on, kind of coming up with like different difficulty levels or game lengths.
Yes.
Mark, you were working on putting together a list of asset updates that you want to do to the graphics.
Yeah, making a big old to-do list and ending the day feeling like I accomplished nothing.
You organized yourself. That's important.
Yeah, admin. I did admin.
Mm-hmm.
It's important, but...
Yes. Yes. Fair.
It was exciting.
Yeah.
And I spent all day working on the rules and didn't feel like I got even close to done. And I didn't feel that way when we started playtesting, and I felt even more that way after.
Well, let's talk about, because before we set on our three sort of like work days yesterday, we did sort of do a run through of the teach.
Yeah.
And so for folks who are not familiar with the board game hobby, and I consider myself like a visitor in that space as a player, an important part of it is the teach, and it's pretty common when you have a board game night. Someone often either has read the rules already or knows has played a bunch.
Yeah.
If you're like into the, if you're really working for it, and then the most ideal way is that someone teaches everybody else.
Yes.
Rather than the inefficient way, which is how it happens pretty frequently if you're not like super into the hobby, which is open the box, pull out the rules for the first time, and everybody struggles through the thing together. That is very common, and that's the scenario we tested.
Yeah.
But very commonly, for people who are really into it, somebody teaches it to everybody else. And when we do playtests for Robostin, I'm that person for the people. And then we stand back. We don't make them read through the rules, although we have from time to time. But most of the time, just in the interest of expediency, I do the teach, which is just to I read the rules kind of as a performance, essentially. I go through it in the way that we had written it previously, and then I insert the things that I think they would need to figure out that are not in the rules, but that are not like teaching them, or telling them how to play or what strategy or anything like that. So because I had honed that over a number of playtests. I did that for the two of you yesterday. And then, Steven, you took a ton of notes.
Yes.
Based on that, because as an outline. And then we identified what was different about that and how it was presented versus the rules we already had.
Mm-hmm.
And then Ellen took all that information and set to work on putting together a new document.
Right.
Whereas we didn't have to do that.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a monumental task. So it's not surprising that you didn't feel completed at the end of the one day we spent on it. Because
yeah.
It turns out writing things is difficult. It's like it's almost like it's like making a game or something, describing how it works.
Well, we did go through this. I mean, Robustin has been in the hopper for a long time.
Yeah.
And I think the first version of the rules, I mean, it was ages ago, mm-hmm. and it was really rough outline. But I think, yeah. Steven, you and I did those.
Oh,
after
sure.
the original sprint.
Yeah.
At the end of 2020 or whenever it was.
Whenever that was. Yeah.
Forever
I do kind
ago.
Of remember that a little bit, yeah.
And then the existing rules up to now is a very technical document.
Yes.
That I prepared, and it took me a long time.
Yeah.
And we all recognize it as, like, not the thing we'd want to ship with the game.
Mm.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's got some flavor, but a lot of times there are things that are just described plainly and then needed some more context, and that's what the teach delivered.
Yeah.
We wanted to bring a little bit into the rules. So that was the task ahead of you, and we gave you one day to do it.
Yeah.
How'd it go?
Well, let's see. We are at 17 pages now,
mm-hmm.
Including some images that need to be resized. But yeah, it's I mean, it's so hard because, like, we have an understanding of the game at an intuitive level that no player, I think, is that you'd have to get to. You'd have to spend a lot of time playing it to get to that point,
right?
Because we have an understanding of how we want the experience to feel. And that's not where players necessarily start. And so we, you know, in the rules, we had to get across all the systems, but it's in a linear fashion. This is not like a new, this is not a revelation. This is just a known challenge, right? Mm-hmm. You're taking a system that is dynamic and is multi-directional, and you're putting it in a document that people read from left to right, top to bottom. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a very linear expression of the rules, but the rules create a system that isn't linear.
Yeah.
So... it's just a challenging thing. I think some parts worked. I think that my dad was the one to read the rules out loud, and he seems to be of the type where it's like I put it in the beginning of the document. I was like, okay, this is written, so you can just start, go phase by phase, read the phase, do the things, then move on to the next phase.
Yeah.
It is not what he did. I did say, like, skim the document ahead of time. He went through the entire document.
Yeah.
Literally word for word, and it drove my mom insane.
Well, what's interesting is that a couple of... I mean, it's the ultimate stress test, right? Mm-hmm. Is to make one person read it while other people have to learn it.
Yeah.
Because... And then we can't control how that happens, and that's mm-mm. the perfect sort of test environment.
Right.
And one of the things that I thought of just now when we were doing notes before we started is, like... That's common to all games,
yeah.
Because what will happen, and the thing that I really learned last night was where you stop talking if you're, like, reading out the rules to the people around you and then start discussing with them is incredibly relevant and completely arbitrary.
Yeah.
So, like, having these, like, breakpoints in the rule book is very helpful, because and sometimes they would hit those breakpoints, talk a little bit about what that last section was, and then... your dad would pick up again in the next section.
Mm-hmm.
But then as it went on, he started stopping at random points.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they started theorizing
for
like 5 to 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Even though the answer was the next sentence in the rules.
Right.
And we're sitting there like going, but that's what happens, right?
Yeah.
And that's not a problem unique to us or to our rules, but we have to sort of like do our best to provide those waypoints so they're as intuitive as possible, so that it's not our fault that they're stopping in random places, that there's a natural stopping points. Whether they do them or not is ultimately on them.
Yeah.
But it made me think about, like, oh, because I've never seen this in a rule book before, but mm-hmm. like, even just a thing at the very top that says, if you're reading these rules to others, stop at the red line every time. You know what I mean? Like, just like little instructions for rules readers.
Mm.
Like, I wonder, that'd be like an innovation that all rule books should have. I don't know if I want to rock the boat too much, but, like, I don't know. What do you think of that?
Because
that was a problem I noticed.
I definitely think having, like, breakpoints in using, like, even a big old red line in between those breakpoints would be helpful.
Yeah.
I don't know if we necessarily have to say stop at the red line every time. But I think, I don't know, it might help.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think that would be valuable. Yeah, because you were right. Like, they definitely did, like, pause at a thing and be like, how does this thing work? And yeah, the next sentence would explain how this thing worked, but they paused it right before they got there, so they don't have that information.
What's so fascinating about it is the one that was really interesting that was early on, I took a note on, is there's when we describe the objective. So in RoboStin, there are multiple objectives. You draw one, and that's the scenario you play through in that playthrough.
Yep.
And so every game is a little bit different. And the rules say how you get that, which is just to shuffle the deck and draw one randomly. Mm. And then we say, hey, if you're a first-time player, you should probably pick this one because it's the introductory one, high tide scenario, as we call it. That is one of the places they stopped, is between those two pieces of information.
Yeah.
And what was interesting about that is that's not that critical, but they ended up spending a lot of time thinking about it and talking about it and looking through them.
Right.
Whereas if we had just swapped the order of those two sentences, then they could have decided, oh, we're first-time players, let's just pick this one. They don't have to, right? Because we do phrase it as a recommendation.
Right.
But knowing that before they engage in the, okay, so let's just do that. Because a lot of times the rule book is also instructions. You read the thing and then you do it. Then you read the next thing and you do that.
Yeah.
And so like the order of information, which we were incredibly cognizant of and talked about a lot in last week's episode, like it is so much more granular than I think we realized.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of can't. I mean, you can hope that people will get through a whole paragraph and then, but you kind of have to do it on a sentence to sentence basis.
Yeah.
And kind of imagine what would happen if they stopped reading now. What would they not know?
Right.
You know, whereas in there's power to language and actually an improvement in understanding by presenting things in here's information, here's context for that information. And that's a natural way to want to write, even in technical writing.
Yeah.
But that instinct can provides an opportunity for confusion in this context where, like, you're not just reading through it by yourself.
Yeah.
You know? And that was a little bit eye-opening, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a lot. I mean, I will, to be fair to your family, Ellen, I don't think that, like, I think it was definitely our rules that were the problem and not your family.
Oh, no. I mean, yes, they were the perfect people to play test the rules.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, it was fine. It's just, like, illuminating of how challenging it is going to be to write this. Because the thing is, like, you really write everything out and then it just doesn't feel fun anymore.
What's strange, and they recognized they were having trouble.
Yeah.
And we would like let them know, like, just so you know, if you're having trouble, it's our fault. Just always, mm-hmm.
right.
always just to make it like less stressful for them.
Yeah.
And then, but once they figured it out, like they really figured it out.
Yeah.
That was the thing that like mm-hmm. made me after, I mean, it took it, it's, of all the playtests we've run, whether it's me giving the teach or you doing the teach, Steven, or us giving the rules over, this group took the longest and had the most confusion, which is like there's 30 different variables. You can't really track what exactly, right? Mm. Because there's definitely, certainly, like there's things in the new rulebook that are like way better than the old rulebook.
Yeah.
So like, but then because we were rushed through it and it was sort of unfinished, and some limbs you went out on, Ellen,
you didn't land
quite. Yeah. They broke maybe, but once they knew how the game worked, they had it.
It just went.
They discovered strategies. They didn't need to. They almost never needed a reference back to the materials unless it was something that was obviously our fault.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like a phrase was wrong or a typo or just a layout thing.
Some of the pieces didn't match the, you know, like some the pieces are old compared to the rules, right?
Yeah. So. Which is like, well, yeah, whatever. That's just how it goes. That's mm-hmm. that's part mm-hmm. of the process. But when you think of a lot of games where you have to reference why does it work this way, one of the big questions you have is not like, oh, do you do this thing before or after that? You look in the rules to find out. But one of the motivations for wanting to know that is because it then determines how you play. And you don't remember what the right strategy is. And very frequently when you look up rules, it's because it's not intuitive to you what it would be.
Right.
Yeah.
This group who had the most trouble and were given and we put them through the worst case scenario on how to do it, they didn't have any of that kind of trouble.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so that gave me a ton of confidence in the game.
Yeah.
You know, because like you describe your parents as like not game players, and RoboStin is not a heavy game, but it is a board game hobby type game. It's still, it's very light for those things, but it's not Parcheesi. It's not Scrabble, right?
Yeah.
And they didn't have any problem with getting on that ramp. You know?
Right.
You know, your husband, Eric, who is sitting there beside them learning and having his own frustration because he is a board game hobbyist.
Yes.
And they essentially, like, he didn't have a one-up on them in terms of understanding how the game worked or what strategies to play.
Yeah.
Necessarily. And which is, there's a pretty wide gulf between your parents and your husband on that.
Yeah.
And he had played the game before years ago. So,
yeah.
So probably remembered some things and maybe understood a little bit more of the concepts.
Actually, that's interesting. I don't think he brought that up. Like, I think he intuited things due to his knowledge of previous games, but I don't think he was like, oh, I remember how this worked in the past.
Yeah, I think, he didn't. Yeah, he was learning it all anew.
Yeah.
But some of those, like, extra things that come when you play a game twice, even if it is years apart, he did have that advantage, I think.
Yeah, oh, for sure, for sure.
But it didn't seem to be that he was, like, walking all over them in terms of, like, why you'd want to do a thing, what the right strategy was.
Right.
Like, they seemed to get it as well as he got it, which was really, like, validating, I think, for our design. I think our design—it's a good game, y'all.
Turns out, yeah, yeah.
I don't know that I would be as confident in it if they didn't have so much trouble, you know, untethered with the rule book.
Yeah,
you know.
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah, yeah. The rules kind of speak for themselves, I guess. Once you understand them,
yeah.
It just takes. We have to explain it better somehow, and then it just takes time. But yeah, yeah. It was. I appreciated that they still enjoyed the game after the fact. You know, they went through all the struggle and they still liked the game afterwards. That's good to hear.
Even my dad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He kept saying, great game. So it's like, all right.
Yeah.
He seemed to be the most frustrated because he was the one reading the rules.
Yep. And he was getting the most, like, stress from the other players.
Yeah.
Right.
Because, like, they were kind of like, you're not doing this right.
Yeah.
Which is every person who reads rules always gets that heat from the other players.
Yeah. You know? That's just how it is.
Like, why aren't you PBS Sesame Street? Why is this not coming so naturally and elegantly to me?
Yeah.
And they never blame the rule book. They always blame the person reading the rules.
Because they're at the mouth of the voice.
Yeah, exactly. But all three of them not only, you know, liked the game, mm-hmm. but talked to us about what was interesting about the game.
Yeah.
Like, they engaged with it thematically with a depth that was impressive, I thought. And that was so satisfying.
Yeah, it was great. It was just great to hear all of that feedback. And that was what made me feel confident in how the game was being received, is, like, just them very clearly enjoying what they were doing and developing strategies as they were going, and I could see what they were thinking in ways that it's kind of interesting for, like, when you're designing the game and improving it and stuff from a board game developer perspective. It's just kind of different. Not that different, but just, like, a little different. In how you see players experience your game.
Yeah.
Because you could kind of see the strategies forming in a way that, like, a board game cannot lead you in where a video game can. And so I think that was just kind of nice. It was good to see that. I mean, also, your family was particularly vocal about, like, the strategies they were making and stuff, too, which was nice. It helped us understand what we were thinking, too.
Yeah.
We
told them several times that what they were doing was super helpful, even though we were just sitting there not saying anything for most of it.
Mm.
Not saying anything, but every 3 minutes, Mark would take out his phone and make a note about something.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I have tons of notes.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are just, like, very specific that we don't need to get into on the show.
Yeah, yeah.
But a lot of them are, I think, are relevant into, like, they're either very insightful or, either validating or confounding.
Yeah.
And that was kind of fun. One of the things that was sort of interesting is the things I've been very concerned about in terms of, like, player understanding. Like, does this thing look right? Is the icon correct? Is this confusing? There's a certain kind of, like, you get really obsessed with there being no space for ambiguity. And especially, like, the big criticism I have a lot of board games is the sort of willingness of designers to, like, have it a little ambiguous and just let you figure it out because it's not that hard to figure out when there are solutions to it. A lot of board games ultimately feel kind of sloppy to me in that way. Like the way that, you know, like different token types will have to, one will be like a graphic and one will be like an illustration.
Oh, sure.
And they're both meant to be part of the same system. And then there's a third token that's illustrated in the same style as the second, but it's part of a different system.
Yeah.
And like, that's all fine. It's not going to be that hard to figure out. But, like, there's a sort of intuitiveness to a lot of those things that I get really, like, because I think that's it's the Mario level 1-1 thing, where it's like, you'll never know about it unless someone explains to you. Like, that's how you know Mario can get power-ups from jumping on things, is because the ceiling is too low.
Yeah.
Like, it's amazing, right?
Yeah.
And so I would get obsessed with that. And a couple of them were things that that I've been trying to come up with solutions for that seemed a little bit insurmountable or would have drawbacks. And so I was like, well, what's the, you know, what's the best of which problem is lesser?
Mm.
And then watching the your family like not worry about any of that stuff.
Yeah.
So like one of them was like, we're thinking about the cards that give the hidden roles in the game.
Yeah.
Which we'll talk about a little bit more when we talk about like the sort of change of work that we did this weekend. Mm. But in one of them, there are two special roles in the game. One is the project leader. That's a player that has special powers in the game. And then the other one is the reluctant hero, which is an optional role that happens near the end of the game. And they're both just normal cards like all the other roles. They sort of are, they're treated differently in the rules, but the cards for themselves are the same. And the what I've long been frustrated by is we have this like letter coding for them so you can like find them easily.
Mm.
And like project leader is A and reluctant hero is B, and this isn't relevant. You don't need to know this, listener, but like how that works. But because there, B is never the reluctant hero role. The role B is never listed on an objective as a role to hand out to a player.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. It's like, why does it even have the letter B on it? Why should it be Z? So it's at the end. Like, does it really matter? And like, it doesn't really matter.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of the ideas I think I came up with when we were just sort of whispering to each other in the corner. I was thinking about that as they were trying to figure out the role cards, and I was anticipating some confusion there.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, you know what? The reluctant role is different. Let's make the back different as well, because it's never part of the shuffled deck.
Right.
It's a special card. You never need you need to find it.
Yeah.
When it's time to find it.
Yeah.
So having it in the deck is a little strange. It should just be its own card.
Yeah.
Even though it's a role like any. And so anyway, I was suggesting that you're like, oh, that's a good idea. And then they didn't, when they were shuffling through, it didn't. They didn't notice this weird one that didn't make it, wasn't part of the set.
Yeah.
And then at the very end, when they were reading through when that role came into play, mm-hmm. I think your mom said, oh, that's probably just in the box then with the other cards. And then your dad and your husband, yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Like, they just intuited
where
they would find it. And right. I was just like, I've been worried about that for so long. And it just doesn't matter. You know, like just little things like that you just kind of get hung up on.
Yeah.
And then you realize, like, oh, it's actually just fine. Like, it's, you know?
That's game design, for real, though.
Yeah. But, like, also, one of the things that we've talked about a lot in playtests is our resource cards have... our resource cards have four different possible values.
Yes.
3, 1, -1, and -3.
Right.
Again, listener, not relevant. You know why that's the case. But it's like a deck of cards. There's sort of suits and values.
Mm-hmm.
And there's three suits, and those are the four possible values. And they're designed visually with Roman numerals, which is kind of fun. They're just one line or three lines. And that's a kind of neat visual language.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally, we'll get people confused until they play the game. They've only seen one or two of these cards.
Yeah.
Not realizing that they're Roman numerals. And then they all figure it out eventually. I'm like, oh, okay, maybe that's that confusion is not worth the charm of it.
Mm.
And then like, oh, maybe I should change it to be like icon, like an actual suit of cards where the icons are just multiples of the icons.
Yeah.
And I think that's still a good idea. But then your family had, I mean, not even an iota of confusion about card values in a way that I think that board game hobbyists would come in and be confused by at certain playtests. And I think that doesn't tell you anything objective. That just tells you that there is such a wide variability.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much about not just the order in which we present things in the instructions, but like literally the order that you take things out of the box. Like stuff that we have no control over.
Yeah.
That you kind of just like, there are no solutions. And a certain part you have to stop considering, you have to stop trying to solve that when there are other considerations. Like, the visual charm of it is relevant. And so maybe that does matter more than that clarity, because you can make it clearer, but it's not going
to
help the people who you thought it would, and it isn't actually a big enough problem for other people, and you'll never do enough playtests to know for sure.
Yeah,
you know,
it's true.
So there's a lot of faith in when you do these designs, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. in playtesting, it feels like a scientific process. It's really not.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, it's all just a feel thing.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, it is. You could get it scientific, but the amount of time, like, you'd never get the funding for it.
Right.
Yeah, the scale of it is such. There's just way too many. You know, we talk about how big and complicated games are. No, really. No, really.
No, really.
And this is one of those things. Like, when you play test, you could play test 1,000 people, and that's essentially no data.
Mm.
Like, when it really comes to, like, you know, it's enough. It's certainly enough to work with. Like, please,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
If you can get two playtesters, get your two playtesters.
Right.
It's valuable.
Yes.
But the space is so big that actually covering it all, you know, would be essentially impossible. No game has sold enough copies for that to be true, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Imagine playtesting Monopoly, like that game. It's all over the place. Still not enough information. Ah, it's silly. But yeah, it's true.
Kind of gives you an appreciation for like the challenges of designing experiments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Think about all the variability and the variables specifically that go into an experience of a game.
Mm-hmm.
And what you need to do to control those variables.
Right.
And then you think about what's, you know, the amount of effort that goes into controlling variables for stuff that studies life, which is more complex than a game. Oofta.
Yep. Oh gosh. I definitely appreciated I definitely appreciated how quick everybody was at like developing their strategies in the game. Eric was talking about like right from turn one, he's like, I'm gonna do it this way, and he did do it that way the whole time, and it did not work out for him because he ended up not winning.
No one won.
Yeah, no one won. They all tied. Which
I'm sorry. They all won.
Well, they all
won. They all won.
But like,
dear listener, this is one of the. This is what, I would describe this as an innovation of this game. And Eric sort of praised the sort of competitive, which is a term, cooperative competitive. Boston is a game where everyone plays on the same team.
Yeah.
But then at the end of the game, you reveal individual roles, and you can win again as an individual.
Yes.
If the team loses, then the person who would have won individually is the sole loser.
Right.
So there's a lot of push and pull on that. We're pretty proud of that system. But it is something that I think it takes a little while to understand. Because we talk about that, at the end you roll these objective die to see who gets the most points and who's the real winner, quote unquote.
Yeah.
And in it, nobody ended up scoring any points on those die.
Right.
And so they all tied. And you both described it. The two of the designers of this game both described it as everybody lost.
Yeah.
When what that actually meant is that everybody won because everybody won.
Well,
and there was no extra winner.
Yeah, I guess. It depends on your view. Like, I do appreciate that aspect of Robustin in that there are two victories. In that you completed the objective and potentially you could win. You did your role the best.
And you get to decide what you care about as a player and as an observer, right?
Yes.
Because the whole team won, but nobody got the special win.
Right.
It is not inaccurate to say nobody won.
Right.
In a way that if they had all lost and then the same thing happened, you would say they all lost.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
In a sense. Yeah. Even though there was no special loser, perhaps.
Yeah.
And that's something that, like, I've always loved. I've always tried to bring it in the games that I make, which is, like, in the end, what the game says happened is just, that's the game's opinion.
Mm-hmm.
You actually get to decide what happened.
Right. I mean, arguably, Eric won because he got victory die, even though, or not victory die, but I forgot what the name of the die were called. He got the most die. And so, like, even though he rolled and he didn't get any points from the die, he still got the most die. So,
and
like,
pointedly,
he can say,
the game is explicit about that not mattering.
Right.
It's about the successes you roll on the objective die.
It does say that.
But you are free to interpret it as like.
And that's how Eric interpreted it too. Like, he wasn't like, well, I got the most die, so I won. He never said that.
Right.
He just was like, well, we all tied. So I guess.
But he can still feel pride in getting the most die.
Yeah.
Even if someone else had fewer and rolled a higher score.
Yes.
You can still, because, you know, that can be your own private interpretation of how it is. And it's like a contemplation on what winning even is. And I love that about this game. I love this about this game probably more than the two of you do.
Yes,
I
you
think.
Do.
I really like it. It's just, I'm like now consumed with fixing the rules.
Yeah,
it's
that's
just like
fair.
The perennial trap of like, okay, this is great. It's an amazing thing. And it's broken. It's not broken. It's great. Mm. But, like, I could be better.
Yeah. That's kind of how it always is.
Yeah.
What I like about that specific aspect of it is because you get to choose what your victory condition is, you can basically, there's so many ways to interpret yourself as winning in a way that I think is good. This is what I liked about Metro Nexus, is that I would always be, well, I guess I would most of the time lose because I always contended victory being, covered all of the spaces.
And you never were able to do that.
And it was so difficult.
It's a big challenge you set yourself on,
But I appreciate that aspect of it because, like, it never, Metro Nexus never really told me that I was the winner. I just decided that I would be the winner because I needed the ego boost.
Yeah. and that's a competitive game, yeah. Whereas this is, at its heart, a cooperative game.
Yes.
And what's nice about it is that, and I think this is, I think, Eric was telling us how much he really appreciated those dynamics in a way that he hadn't seen in a lot of other games, and that was very flattering.
Yeah.
Because, like, he would know.
Yeah.
But I think we did stumble into a little bit through our intentions rather than our expertise.
Yes.
And so that's great. Mm-hmm. I don't want to credit us for being, like, you know, really, like, solving the equation. I think it's just that that was what we wanted to do, and we were somehow able to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the idea that, like, if you go into it only worried about your individual goal, and you're only just keeping the team alive at a chance at your individual goal, that you basically cannot ruin anybody else's attempt, even if they're not interested in their individual goal. And those can even have some synergy. So early on, your mother was the project leader, Ellen, and and when we described, like, your motivation is to have to get this done as soon as possible, and they figure that out pretty quickly from even just going through the rules.
Yeah.
But then early on, she decided that the team was not working well enough together for her to pressure them to move faster. So she gave up on her individual goal and was happy to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Eric was like, great, now I have no pressure. I will then drag it out.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they both had a fine time.
Yeah.
And which was really neat, right?
Yeah.
Whereas if she had put the pressure on him, like, how much would he have pushed back? I would be very curious to see
that.
Would have
been,
but that makes the game dynamic. Mm-hmm. Like, a different playthrough would have a different result.
Right.
You really can play however you want, and and it doesn't mess anybody else up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which there's a lot of games where that is not true of.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's cool in that way, for sure. Ellen is thinking.
She's so close to a thought, you guys.
I know.
No, I'm having all the thoughts. It's just, it's the flexibility of that, like, for it. It's cooperative and competitive, right?
Yes.
It's not, and you can lean into one or the other as a player and as a group, which is interesting. I think if you're, you know, a good-natured group that is kind of used to poking at each other, then you might see more, like, a group like that to have more of the forced heroic sacrifice dynamic.
We had a playtest group about maybe a month or two ago, which was all like, you know, the kinds of pals that would razz each other all the time. Like, that friend dynamic. The entire time, they were all threatening. The project leader was threatening, if you don't fall in line, I'm going to do a heroic sacrifice on you.
Yeah.
Nice.
And then the people were like, I'm not pushing nothing. And it was just this constant sniping back and forth, laughing the whole time.
Yeah.
Total distrust.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the team lost their objective. And they were thrilled.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. Well, that's the other thing, too, is, like, and I think this is something that I need to maybe spend some more time away from the rule book to get back into, is, like, because I spent all day yesterday slogging through the rules.
Yeah.
Right.
It ended up feeling like a much heavier game in my head.
Sure.
Than it actually is. And so, like, the tension and the flexibility between cooperation and competition, individual versus group, like, is great because the game isn't actually that long.
Right.
You know, like, yes, you can play it for 2 hours, but you'll play multiple scenarios in that 2 hours. If you're just playing one, like, you know, we spent like 2 hours on this playtest last night, and I think they spent less than half an hour actually playing.
Yeah.
Which is like, the rules, man. But once you get the rules, then it's like, you're just there. You can just be in the zone together and have fun with it. So I think I need to.
Plus, the decision making you have to make in between during your turns is not that complicated.
No, not really.
Which makes it faster.
Yeah, it moves quickly.
Yes.
Yeah, and you know, you have you can do so little on your turn, which is designed so that you have to share information to get anything done.
Right.
And so it has to move fast. As a result of that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really interested, Stephen. You were spending yesterday creating new objectives.
Yes.
And we didn't test any of those because that's, you know, we're trying to be scientific, one variable at a time.
Yeah.
But we were testing scenarios that were designed to be longer or shorter than the standard.
Yeah.
Which is all we've ever tested.
Yeah.
Even though from the beginning we always wanted you to be able to decide a short game, a medium game, a long game.
Yeah.
We only ever designed scenarios for the medium game.
Yeah.
And that turned out to be great, like almost ideal. And it made sense that that's the standard.
Right.
But we still liked the idea of the epic challenge or the, you know, quickfire challenge.
Right. So I focused a lot of my time. Yeah, I focused all my time yesterday on doing that.
Yeah.
Designing some smaller challenges and some long challenges. And you were going to ask me a question, though, Mark. Because I could go on about it, but I don't know.
You know, we're about halfway through the episode runtime, yeah. So let's do a cliffhanger.
Oh, okay.
I'll ask Steven about that after this.
All right, we're back. We're beating the drum. Patreon, please. We need money.
Patreon. So the Patreon money helps us do a couple things, right?
Yes.
First of all, there's infrastructure. There's technology infrastructure that goes into, like, getting the episodes out,
right.
You know, on all the different things.
Yes.
And, go, you know, clicking in and connecting with the website and stuff, because Mark put together an awesome website that lets you search for different things, and
right.
It's got tags, and it's got categories, and it's got guest labels, and there's so much in there.
Mm-hmm.
And
relevant to this conversation, hosting costs.
Yes.
And hosting costs. So the Patreon dollars cover some of that. They also help us give Max some amount of money every month.
Yes.
Who,
you
know,
guest booker.
Our guest booker, right? So every time you hear a guest on our show, that's because Max reached out to them and scheduled them and organized the whole thing, and he deserves to get paid for his work.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't get paid for this because we like making episodes.
Yes.
And sharing them.
Yes.
Yeah.
But we do have some costs, and it's really, really helpful to get the Patreon dollars rolling in every month, because, you know,
yeah.
Those costs don't go away.
And for the folks who are Patreon subscribers, like, it has made a big difference already.
Absolutely.
Like, you know, Max deserves to be paid. We do not pay him enough.
Yes.
And our income does not cover what we pay him. Like, that's the squeeze we're in as a small program.
Right.
And so the people who are already signed up, like, it existential to making this operation move as smoothly as it does, and illustrates the need that we run an efficient, cheap, money losing operation here. And so you know, your couple of dollars will help us lose a little bit less money. And think about what value it provides to you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is the guilt angle, but you know, I think we're doing a lot here. I think we provide a service.
Yeah.
And we would love for you to join us, but you know, there's the what's in it for us. What's in it for the listener?
Right. You get ad-free episodes, Patreon exclusive content, and good feels.
Yeah. That's benefit number one.
Yes.
Like, bonus stuff, great. No ads in the middle of the show. Fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if you're anything like us,
right.
Those feels is what you have to.
Yeah,
you have the feels
is nice.
And you can get feels. You can get such feels for $2.50 a month. $2.50
yeah.
US.
Yeah. Yes, it's
which
great.
Which is like a soda. Or, sorry, we're in Minnesota. It's a pop.
Guess we're sticking with that angle.
Yeah.
Go to patreon.com/nicegamesclub if you'd like to support.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Terms and conditions apply.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So where was I? Yes, Stephen, tell us about these objectives you created.
Yes.
Because we were all in our little worlds yesterday, mm-hmm. and we were bouncing ideas over the table as necessary.
That's true.
But we did a pretty good job of letting each other do the work that we needed to do.
Yeah.
And so I actually don't know a lot about these missions. You pinged me back and forth, and I think I tossed some ideas your way.
Yeah.
But I wasn't keeping track of yours or my thoughts.
Oh, I guess that's
so.
True. I suppose I thought that y'all had a better understanding of what I was working on than I... than you actually did. That's fair.
Well, I'm using our airtime so that you can educate me, and meanwhile our listeners can find out what goes into this process.
Right, right. Okay, so what I did, I focused on the two different sizes for Robustin scenarios that we have, or two new ones, because we have the standardized size that we've been using. Mark said it before the break, that we've mostly just had that, but we had all long wanted to have varying sizes because I don't know, we thought that would be interesting. And so I spent all of my time coming up with different ones that we could do for those. But I recognized early on that it actually changes, specifically the shorter ones, changes a lot of the dynamics of the game. The longer ones aren't so bad. It maybe changes like some of the balance, because the way that the project leader gets die is just how many turns there are, and if there's more turns, then, you know, the project leader gets potentially more die, but also that gives everybody else more opportunities to complete their roles, and they get more out of more turns.
Right. Their objective die at the end scales in a way that the project leader's probably doesn't as much.
Right. Yeah. So we were talking about that a little bit, but, and I didn't come to a conclusion as to whether or not we, like, should do something about that with respect
to balance.
I had some
ideas for you, and they were all pretty bad, I think.
No, they weren't bad. It was just, like... It was a lever I didn't feel like we needed to pull right away.
Oh, okay.
And I think part of it, one of the ideas was just changing it so that the project leader maybe gets scales differently if you're playing an epic length one versus a normal one. But outside of like that, the balance of things, I think epic ones tend to be about the same, at least from what I theorized, because we didn't test them. But the shorter ones, I think right now we're calling them emergency sized ones. Mm-hmm. Those ones really change the dynamics because you don't have enough time to really, you don't even have enough time to influence the robot that much.
Yeah.
And so like you kind of only have like one goal in mind. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important for like in order for the game to work, like you have to have at least a little bit of time in order for things to change.
And what's interesting about that as you were sort of coming up with, we're putting them together and sort of saying, hey, this is kind of a problem. And I think I was bouncing back and forth. I need these more.
Yes.
But I would love to hear what these missions actually are that you came up with.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But before, because I do want to talk about what I do remember from those conversations.
Yes.
Which is, and it got me kind of excited because what it does is it's like, it distills the sort of dynamics of Robustin into like a very simple, simple things.
Yeah.
So in the game, if you have a hidden role, you have a special objective, and a big part of your motivation is to influence the construction of the robot to benefit you without revealing that you're doing it for your own purpose.
Yeah.
And you're trying to physically bluff your way, and also, if you can, try to make your things benefit the robot and you, which we do our best to not, for the roles and the objectives to not allow you to do that.
Right.
But you can find ways to sort of trick your other players into thinking that you're earnestly trying to help everybody when you're really mostly trying to help yourself.
Yeah.
Or you could have played a different thing that would have helped people more.
Yeah.
In the shorter version, there's not as much space for that kind of like complexity.
Exactly.
So you kind of have to either play cooperatively and then just everyone works together.
Yeah.
Or you have to go for your individual thing and not try to hide it.
Right.
Because you just do not have enough time to be subtle.
Yeah.
And I
yeah.
think at first I was like, oh, that's kind of a bummer. That subtlety is important. But I'm like, actually, that's like distilled Robustin.
Yeah,
that's kind of cool.
It was kind of interesting because like initially I was like, this isn't going to work because it completely changes the game. And it's like a very different dynamic now. And I don't even think that this makes a lot of sense for Robustin. Then I was like, Mark, maybe we should cut this. And then you were like, no. you brought up a lot of reasonings as to why we should keep it, because you're right. It is.
Well,
kind
I
of
also distilled. Said maybe we should cut
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
like,
were,
I,
yeah.
I didn't come. I didn't catch on to what was interesting about it right away.
But then you
at
got
first,
like super excited about yeah. thinking about it, and I was like, oh, maybe
talk
there's
myself
potential.
Into it, kind of.
Yeah. Which was really was
did
great.
I sell you?
Like, you did.
Okay,
you did.
Good.
Well, I mean, I made some, so. You made me do work, so that must be enough.
Right.
I thought that was so. Basically, I just changed my thinking on how these were supposed to work,
yep.
right? So most of the objectives in Robustin have requirements. You have to have a certain stat amount before you can actually, like, potentially succeed at this at the objective.
Yeah.
If you don't, you automatically fail.
Makes the game approachable. You can understand your group motivations without having to interpret the tasks of the objective.
Yes. Yeah. But with all of the shorter ones, I got rid of all of the requirements for those, at least for the time being. There's probably room for changing that, but mm-hmm. I figured this seems fine for
I
now.
I think that's super clever.
Yeah, yeah. Well, because, like, really, is the intention is that players need to interpret the rules of the objective in order to determine what their goals are, and I made them broad enough so that, like, you can approach them from many different ways, and you just, as a team, need to collaborate on what you want from it. And you only have a certain amount of time. You only have such a short time in order to do it that I think that that's kind of the more interesting gameplay aspect, is, like, cooperating with one another and developing a plan right away versus, like, recognizing that, like, people are changing the plan and then changing it. And then changing your strategy over time,
yeah.
you don't have time for that, right?
Well,
you
also
only have
in the standard length missions, the way there's, we didn't design the game so that the group has to make a lot of collective decisions.
Yes,
like let's go for this instead of that. There are ways to do things differently.
Yeah,
but most of the objectives have a pretty easily understand recommended way to approach them.
Yeah,
then it's up to the players to kind of fiddle at the nibble at the edges. With their own motivations.
Mm-hmm.
But what I think you did really cool with these short ones, as you described them, is, like, it's they are very much based on group decision making.
Right.
And so that when players do something different, it's even clearer.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Or players can force a group decision by going first.
Right.
Or by going second and making a stronger move in that direction. And that is, it's a very different way of doing Robustin, but it hits all the same themes.
Yeah, yeah. The your actions have more weight because there's just because there's less time to do them.
Yeah.
And so also your negotiation strategy within the table is more important because you have less time to make decisions. So you kind of want to try, if you want to win through negotiation, win personally through negotiation. then you need to be, like, really just. You need to be really clear up front early on that, like, this is how you think we should go about doing it. Because it, specifically with these objectives, it kind of any way could potentially work. And especially because, like, the way the any objective success works anyways, it's somewhat random. Not just somewhat random. It's pretty random. anything could go. So you just have to, like, convince people that it makes whatever way makes sense for you and specifically. Anyways, this is all theoretical because we did not test these, right? So
yeah. Well, this, I mean, it reminds me a lot of when we were coming up with sort of scenarios,
right?
You know, years ago when we started putting this game together,
yeah.
And just, like, thinking about, like, what, and then, yeah, we'll just have to put them on the field and see how it goes.
Yeah.
But now we know what we want to test against.
Yeah.
Like, is it doing this or not? And if it's not, how can we make it do it? Or is it impossible to do this?
Yeah.
And, like, and so we have a direction for that part of the game where we never before now, it was just always, that's a thing that we imagine will happen.
Yeah.
We never had any idea on what that was.
Yeah.
And that's really cool. Like, I was expecting a lot of, like, you were saying, like, I'm going to make some content this weekend.
Yeah.
But ultimately and this is just because I haven't looked at your objectives.
Yeah.
But to me, from where I'm sitting, you did a ton of design work this weekend.
Yeah. Yeah. For
which
sure.
Which is really cool.
It was helpful to have, there were a bunch of scenarios that we have in the box that just don't have, like, actual rules or requirements or anything set for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I went through some of those and I just, like, determined that, like, this one could maybe work for a long one and this one could maybe work for a short one. So I took a couple of them There's one called Metro Meteor that you wrote. I can read the flavor text.
Yeah. So, when we came up with these missions, yeah. So I did a lot of the creation for the missions that are currently in the game.
Yes.
And some of them were based on our brainstorms, but then I think I pretty much wrote all of the ones as they are.
Yeah.
But then I wrote a couple of flavor text, like concepts for them without any idea how they would work.
Yeah.
And there was like 8 of those or something. And you took the ones of those you liked and
yeah,
made...
I took a few of them. I didn't take as many as I thought.
Because you made some of your own as well.
I did make some of my own.
Yeah, yeah. But then did all the design work for you.
Yeah, I made more short ones, or I remade more short ones, and I made my own longer ones, I think, a lot of the time. But an example of a short one here is, Metro Meteor. The flavor text is no big deal. But astronomers have detected a very small asteroid on a collision course with the city. Let's keep this quiet, okay? Robot, catch and release.
Catch and release.
Yeah.
For all the design things I love about this game, I had maybe the most fun with these little bits of flavor text and the tone of it.
They're fun,
and the
right.
secret of it, and you really did a great job of this yesterday with the ones you came up with. I went crazy for it.
Thank you.
There's always one sentence in there that will make you bust out laughing.
Yeah.
But it's in context, right?
Yeah.
So in this one, it's no big deal.
Yeah.
No big deal.
Right? But you had some gems as well in your new ones.
Thanks.
No big deal, and also catch and release.
Yeah. The rules in that one are if the robot has the highest stat in power, then you check for processing. And then if you get one or more successes, then you complete the objective. Otherwise, you fail it. If you have more processing, if the robot has the most in processing than the other stats, you check for power. And if you get a success, the objective is complete. And with plating, if plating is the highest stat, then you just check plating. And you have to have 2 successes in that one in order to complete that objective.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So my thinking is, people will compete. There's no requirements for the actual, parts or anything. And the guises, the roles that we're using don't compete with respect to parts, except for one, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm not exactly sure how to do roles. I don't know that I did that well, and I still don't quite fully understand how best to put roles to an objective. But
yeah, so
I tried.
So for listeners in the game, the different roles of the different objectives, and because the main objective of the game will often ask you to build the robot with a certain type of resource more than another type of resource.
Yes.
We wanted to make sure that the each objective says these are the roles that you can use.
Yeah.
And so it's a subset of all the available roles and the hidden roles in the game, because some of them are too simpatico with the main objective that would just automatically win. And so that is a big part of the challenge is matching them so that they have that dynamic. And in these short ones, that is essentially, it's less of a restriction because you're basically letting the team decide what's important, and someone's hidden role that might really work for.
Right.
And so that's part of the gameplay. Whereas in the regular ones, that would only happen if we as designers made a mistake in including that role, that objective.
Yeah.
So I think you probably have to worry a little bit less about that compatibility than we have up to now. But it means it's different. It's probably why you had some trouble.
That's why I couldn't go back to previous ones to guide me as well how I was.
Right. There wasn't
to...
a model. It's a newer version. It's a different. Mm-hmm. It's a different, it's like, this game is like Taco Bell. You have the 4 ingredients and something new comes out at the end, right?
Yeah. It's pretty accurate, yes. So that's an example of a short one. I did write up some long ones. I think that the long ones, the way that I, made those feel a little bit different from the shorter ones outside from, the standard ones, is outside of, them just being longer, I also want the act the robot is doing to feel a little more drawn out, more intentional. That's kind of the approach I made. What's really fun about a lot of these objectives is they're still relatively silly because this city just just creates random robots to solve any problem. It's really fun to work with. So one of the ones I came up with is called Bot Envy. And I'll read the flavor text here. Our sister city, Roll Baltimore, has created a slick-looking robot that has all of social media in a tizzy. We can do better than that. Robot, strike a pose.
It's so good.
Thanks.
It's so
good. That one I wrote.
Yeah.
It's so good.
I think the line in that one is, we can do better than that.
Yeah.
That's the one that gets me.
Yeah.
Because it's this silly social media thing, which is is a common source of parody.
Yeah.
But we can do better than that is something you say. It's a serious thing you say.
Right.
And this is not a serious thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
You tell that to a child when they, like, get a B. Like,
yeah.
We can do better.
You know, it's like, it's when you, and you are being a little bit too uptight. And that's what,
yeah.
The attitude to this.
Yeah.
It's just the incongruity is brilliant.
Yeah, it's great. The rules in this one are, the long ones do have requirements. And what's interesting about the requirements for these ones is, like, I tried to make them particularly large to make it clear that you have to work at it. It needs to take longer. And that's why this is a longer one. It's weird that this one's about taking selfies, but it makes sense in context because
take
you want to make
selfies.
Yeah, you take a lot of selfies, but also you want to make a nice looking robot, right? So you spend
obviously
a lot of time adding parts to the robot. That's the requirements that you need to have.
12 story ring light.
Yeah, maybe that's one of the tools. But you need to have 5 or more body parts added to the robot in order for it to be successful when you're taking these selfies. And then there's like a set of things you do to take the selfies. One thing I did notice when I was designing these ones is that like it seemed like some of the stats, like I only picked like a couple of stats, set of 3 stats. Typically, you know, you can use all 3 stats to be interesting for the rules of any of these objectives. I tended to lean towards just picking like 2 stats or 1 stat to be like huge priority or 2 stats to be main priority. And then 1 stat is just like on the wayside. And it made it easier to pick roles for these objectives because of that, which was kind of was nice.
It always gives a fun dynamic when you play too, because it means that a certain amount of the cards in the resource deck are more of them become kind of dead weight or purely for the construction of the robot, but not for obtaining the objective.
Right.
And that dynamic is always kind of fun because, you know, it's different from objective to objective.
Right, yeah. So, like, this bot envy one, it only checks for processing and plating because you're looking at your plating. And I guess you need to coordinate while you're taking the picture.
Uh-huh.
I didn't think it all through.
You need to look smart.
Yeah, you need to look smart. But you still, power is still useful because you still need to make sure you can add more body parts to your robot. And so, like, you need to make sure to add at least a little bit of power to get over there. And then, like, if you get something that encourages, if you get a role that encourages you to add power to the robot, you can use the excuse, well, we need to add this leg, right? And we need a little bit of power for that. And if we go over a little bit, you know, it's not so bad, right? We can just add another part later. So there's a little bit of dynamics in there. The epic ones, I feel like, are going to be the hardest ones to test. Because they're going to feel very similar to the standard ones, but just longer. And so, like, we're just going to get less tests of them as a result.
Yeah.
I'm really excited to test the smaller ones because they'll both theoretically go faster. And those are the ones that make the biggest changes to the dynamics of the game.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to getting more insight as to how those feel when we get a chance to play test them next.
So, the sort of 2 areas left to cover are, you know, some of the little tweaks that we in particular Ellie made to terminology, and a couple of tiny rule tweaks we made.
Yeah,
I think there's very little that we need to change about this game. Design wise, we're really happy with it.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of it is like presentation, just again nibbling around the edges. And then also talk about like what the next steps are.
Yeah.
So first, let's talk about Ellen. As you were putting the rules together yesterday, you identified a couple of places where we could clarify terminology, give different names to things, and also like lean into a little bit of what the game does well elsewhere and do more of that, right?
I'm not sure if I'll be able to remember everything specifically, but I remember we talked about like when you were doing the teach and kind of refreshing all of us on what that sounded like. One thing that kept kind of grating for me was that we had a roll and a roll, right? So like you're going to need to roll dice, but then we also had roll cards.
Yeah.
And you don't really do much with the dice until later on in the game. So you've been really, you know, introduced to the idea of roll cards. And it's not so much a problem when you're reading it, but when you're saying it out loud, as many people will, you know, and that's how they're going to potentially learn by listening to someone else read it. The homonym became an issue.
Yeah.
So we talked about that. And we decided we were going to switch role to guys, which we kind of liked because We talked about, like, is it persona? Is it whatever? We kind of like guys because it kind of implies a hiddenness.
Yeah.
Right? Secretiveness. Mm-hmm. And certainly all the guises, all the roles for players are not revealed unless they're the project leader.
Right.
They're not revealed until the very end. So we kind of like that. And then it also let us kind of change the... like the word like individual objective, because we had like the team's objective and then the player's individual objective, we changed that to goal. So the way that we were saying is like you'll have a hidden guise and a secret goal. Yeah. And then we just use that pattern of language throughout. And
what's nice about that is, and we tempted fate on this one, like other games could probably get away with role mm-hmm. because both terms are actually fairly common. Like, we just it's a hidden roll game. Mm-hmm. You roll dice. Like, those are just the words for those things.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we talked a lot about, like, we all love proper nouns, but we all recognize that, like, you got to keep a check on that sort of thing sometimes before you turn into Scientology or whatever. But, like, I think other games could get away with it more than we could that we didn't recognize till yesterday, because one of the other things that we do with the game's proper nouns, which is my fault, is playful alliteration.
Oh,
so
yes.
our resources are power plating processing.
Uh-huh.
Like, and then the extra components are called peripherals.
I remember us going, like, talking a lot about making it all P during our work sessions. Like,
I do recall being a little nervous that I'd have to fight you guys about it, because I really liked it, but it does introduce potential confusion.
Yeah.
But you went along with me, and I'm glad of it. But I think that probably makes the roll a little worse.
Yeah.
Because it's not that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And Ellen, you solved it with some more playful alliteration.
With more alliteration.
Which is fantastic. Yeah. I love that about it, about your solve. It was brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's going to be a while before we start calling it that.
Yes. Yeah, I still call it rolls.
So we're going to, you know, it'll take us some time, but that's how these things go, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, we talked even a little bit about, like, the name Roboston, which, you know, I've come to terms with, and I've started to lean into, but I didn't love it.
Yeah.
But the both of you did. And now it's like, it has been years. And, you know, we've definitely talked about this on the show before.
Yeah.
Like, what happens when your code name just calcifies.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of it is, you know, we started coming with names for sister cities, Robaltimore,
right,
Minneapolbot, everybody's favorite, Washington Beep Boop. And like, so that because it Roboston became more core to the theming of the game, which isn't to say it couldn't be a game called something different that's set in the city of Roboston.
Yeah.
But we talked a little bit about that yesterday. I don't know that we got very far.
Yeah, we didn't come up with anything.
And is it that we're just guilty about the providence of the name, that it was a code name that just stuck, or do we really think it should change?
I mean, I love the name from jump, and I still do, so I'm not
particularly... Oh, so this is not an issue for you.
I'm not particularly invested in making a new name.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I thought yesterday was, like, if we just changed the game to Giant Helpful Robots. And the reason I even brought it up was, like, because it kind of pops into my mind as cover, like, as box art with just, like, big letters.
Yeah,
Giant Helpful Robots.
Yeah.
And, like, that's the kind of thing that might stand out on a shelf.
That's true.
And I'm not quite abandoning that idea. But the thing is then I was like, well, what would the box art look like for Roboston? And I'd be like, well, it would look like Boston with robots. And that was also cool. So
what I did for key art was I had a city limit sign, like city of Roboston, population 100100100.
Yeah.
Right. And that's fine. I don't know that it might be a little too clever by half, but
yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you're going to want like just a big robot and then a bunch of people who are the players in lab coats as part of the committee that builds it.
Mm-hmm.
I think whatever it's called, that's probably what our key art is.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's what is attention grabbing is the single word that you have to lean into. What's that mean?
Mm-hmm.
Or and this is probably why I don't necessarily love the four word title. That is the sort of like the dry irony of it.
Yeah,
it's because that is it would work because a lot of games do it and do it successfully.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a bad idea.
Yeah.
But I mean, even like Cards Against Humanity or something like you know that kind of. I'm trying to think of other examples. My argument would be stronger if I had more examples. but the idea of just being like, you know, this is what it is. It's what it is. What it says on the tin. Ha ha. And I don't. Maybe I'm a little bit tired of that. But also, I'm a curmudgeon. So
yeah.
Yeah. So we're sticking with the name of Boston. Cool.
Well, I'm the one. I'm like talking about it as an issue. You don't have a problem, and Ellen's the only one who's presented any solutions.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
Like, we're not. Maybe we should just keep it.
Yeah, if we come up, I think that's the thing, is we haven't come up with anything that, like, I do actually like the idea of giant helpful robots, because it is what's on the tin. And I like names that are what's on the tin, even if it's like a little bit in a joking way, because at least at the very least, players know what the game is.
The thing about Roboston is that it could come across as a city simulator.
Sure.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Which would also be cool. It's like, oh, sweet. We get to manage our city made of robots. And yeah, then you open it up and it's like, well, this is not that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But
it's city themed, but it's a robot game.
It's about robots.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We can still have the game set, if we called it Giant Helpful Robots or whatever, we could still have it set in Roboston.
Oh, first, we definitely would.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, the first line of the rule book is, welcome to the city of Roboston,
mm-hmm. yeah.
where there isn't a problem that cannot be solved with a giant robot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and right? It recontextualizes that joke, that
yeah.
pun name. As you know, as a part of the glossary rather than the yeah, and that's good.
Yeah,
right?
But you got to open up the box to get to that point.
Yeah,
right.
Which is okay. I don't have a problem.
No,
with that.
No, what I mean is, like, if you're looking at the box and its name is Roboston, you're like, oh, this must be some weird city building game, and I don't like yeah. want to make that because I'm boring. I guess.
I think that's possible. I think yeah. the fact that the pun starts with robot probably saves
hope,
a little bit
yeah, yeah.
from that, but it could be an issue for sure.
But like, yeah, if you don't get past that point, that is something that.
Yeah.
It's potentially concerning.
And that was my concern originally. It's like, it came with a fun pun, but like, nothing in the game is Boston themed.
Yeah.
Right? And we've really stuck to that and decided that we're not going to go that way.
Mm.
And so I think people might either expect that or wonder when it's going to happen or whatever.
Sure.
It's perhaps. But,
yeah. I suppose it's possible.
But, you know, there are board games with worse names that do great. So.
Absolutely. So doing all right.
Yeah. We made a couple other rule tweaks. I'm trying to think of what they were, but we've done them in the past couple of weeks that we've sort of just solidified now.
I mean, the one thing that I think we've finally solidified into the rules specifically is the change that you came up with during a playtest event
mm-hmm.
A month or so ago.
You could see the light bulb over my head when it happened.
You could, really, though. It was great. At the end of the game, what we had it before is at the end of the game, if the robot fails in the objective, then everyone loses and that's it. The way Mark changed it is making it so that everyone loses and you fail the objective, but someone loses more and everybody rolls their die to determine who loses the most.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious.
And it works really well with the dynamic, because the person who is likely to have caused the team to lose because they were focusing too much on the individual goal.
Yeah.
Is suddenly at a disadvantage. It makes going for the individual goal much more risky.
Yeah.
And it tempers a little bit of what some people have, playtesters have criticized, as the project leader having too much power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because they can force a player to give up their role at the end of the game. And that is meant to temper that player's attempt to try to, you know, go for their objective.
Right.
This is another reason for them to be, to not go for it as much.
Yeah.
And so it makes that potential less ever present, even
yeah.
though it's still there. Playtesters love it.
Yeah,
they love
really
the
good.
Irony of it.
Mm.
And it's easily explained too, because we used to say in the rule book somewhere, and like, I don't know, some description of it, we would say, like, once the game is over, if you've won, now it's time to see who really won.
Yeah,
right. It's mm-hmm. kind of a playful description of it.
Yeah,
and now we get to say, if the robot is successful, now it's time to see who really won. If the robot was, you know, failed, it's time to see whose fault it was.
Yeah.
And those use the same mechanics.
Yes.
And it has that mirrorness that, like,
yeah.
that the rest of the game is pretty good in. So, yeah, I'm very pleased.
What's really fun about that change, I think, is that, like, it works the same way that the win works, in that, like, you can see who has the most die, you can see who was running for it, but, like, that context has changed. So
yeah.
now you can be like, why the heck do you have 9 die? We still didn't win this thing. Right? That's so fun. And you can still actually get away with it if you end up rolling all 9 of your die and you don't get any points, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like then you don't, by the game, I guess, determination.
That's
like
the
you
few
don't,
ending. Like.
Yeah, yeah. You don't get the most points, so you don't get the most blame, quote unquote. But, I mean, everybody on the table still sees what you did.
Which is just, it's like the mirror of what we were talking about before.
Exactly.
Like you could be proud of the most objective die even if you don't roll the most successes.
Yep, yep.
And yeah, that's the, all that extra context lives just a couple inches off the top of the table, and
mm-hmm.
that's so exciting.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, it was good to finally, like, you know, at least in some form, start how we describe that in the rules.
Yeah.
Because in playtests, I would always surprise players with it.
Right.
Because I would do the teach and I wouldn't tell them that.
Yeah.
And then if they lost, originally, like when I came up with it, originally it was like a, how do we make it so that people are not disappointed when they lose and the game just ends?
Mm.
And we haven't had a problem with that, thankfully.
Yeah.
It was something one of those things I really worried about that players do not have a problem with.
Mm.
But when I spring it on them, what I used to say is okay, you know, someone comes in, the mayor comes in and says, you boneheads, if this were a real emergency, we'd all be in trouble.
Yeah.
You know, good thing it was only a simulation.
Yeah.
Like, and that was a fun surprise. You can't really put that in the rule book because it's not a surprise.
Right.
But I would do that just for fun. And then I would have them roll their objectives anyway and see who would have won.
Yeah.
Just so they can do it.
Yeah.
And then it was, just the light bulb of like, oh, let's have them come in and say it's a simulation. Let's see who really effed it up.
Yeah.
And like players love that so much when they discovered it. But I think a lot of what they loved about it was the shock and surprise of it.
Yeah.
Which we're not going to be able to do in the box.
Right.
Which is fine. But it means it gives us a little extra challenge of how we present in the rules.
Yeah.
By like not hammering it too hard so it still feels like fun at the end. But just making sure that is how the game works.
Yeah,
so players' motivations are tied into it.
Right. I think the context shift will still be a bit of a shock for players who were pushing too hard for their particular objective.
Yeah.
In a way that I think will still hold true to like what you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right, it won't hit the exact same way as a result. But you know, it'll be fine, I think.
Yeah. I mean, it's and just everything in this game is risk reward, and it's just more of that, which is really cool.
Yes.
Well, I guess we're reaching the end here.
Yeah.
So longtime listeners know we've talked about Robosson on and off for years, and every time it comes up, we like it more and more.
Mm.
Every time we show it to someone, we realize it really needs. But we've always said like we don't have the time to take it to market.
It's a lot of work,
essentially.
Yeah.
But there's a reason we worked on it this weekend. Partly just so we'd have something to do this weekend, hanging out with Ellen.
Yeah.
So a little bit, it was a good opportunity. But we would love to pitch it at least in some capacity. Try to see if we can get someone else to print and put in a box and
sell
it.
That's the thing. Is like I do enjoy this game, and it would be nice if we could see it on the shelves. It'd be nice if people outside of my circles, I guess, were able to play the game. But it is a lot of work to get a game published, right?
Oh yeah.
And so like we got lucky with Guam because we had Peter. And Peter pitched it, and he got lucky and found somebody.
Mm-hmm. It was like his first or second meeting.
It was actually.
And we were like, "That's all it takes."
Yeah,
yeah.
Little did we know.
And so we got lucky with that game. But I think that Robosson might take more work, and I specifically think that because like Robosson is more board game hobbyist friendly than like Glom was.
Yeah,
Glom is more quote-unquote casual, I think. And so, like, I think it's easier to take a risk on Glom, especially since, like, it's mostly just cards. There's not that many things you have to put in. Like, I think we were just pitching it as just give them a bunch of cards. And
we were saying, like, if you want to keep it cheap, just do it as a deck.
Right. And then any boards of cards, they added pencils and they added a timer and, like, didn't even ask for any of that.
Well, I think even when we first met with them, they were like, I think a card deck would be good. It'd be a cheap way to do it. And then they thought, no, this needs a little bit more.
Yeah.
So credit to them
that they
put a little bit more.
That was on them, and we appreciate it for it.
Yeah.
But I think Robosson like requires like much more than just the deck. It has a deck, but it also has die.
It has like four decks.
Yeah. It's like four decks. It has die, it has robot parts, it has like so many things.
Yeah.
And so like it's more of an ask for publishers, I think, to do it. And so like I think we would actively need to be able to push for it in a way that would be difficult. And also Peter is as sweet as he is, we can't ask him to.
Sweet Peter, he took a copy of Robosson on a trip with him, and he's like, "I want to give this in a room with people," and then he didn't have time to do it.
Right,
and I like what a lovely, brilliant, sweet man.
Yeah,
I love him so much that he was like, "I have no time for this, but I'll try."
Yeah,
and he came back and said, "I didn't have time for this," and we're like,
honestly, they warmed my heart.
It's not what I was looking
just
for.
Just the fact that you brought it with you.
It was very sweet.
It was so much.
But yeah, we need to do that work.
Yeah,
and, we pitched Dogpile last year a couple places. We didn't get a lot of... We weren't in a lot of rooms. I still believe that game, if it was in more rooms, it had more meetings, I believe it would sell.
Yeah, Dogpile...
That's a very mass market game.
That's
sure.
even more casual.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We have never pitched Robosson to anybody.
Right.
And so I think our experiences with Dogpile last year and understanding the limits of our ability to devote to pitching as a group and me individually as well, like is sort of, it's brought a lot of pessimism into this process
That's
for
true.
Us But we have never pitched Robustin to anybody.
Also
so
true.
I would be interested to see what could happen. But what we need to do is what? What do we need to get it in that state?
Well, we need to finish the rules.
Yeah.
Which Ellen is still feverishly working on as we record this
episode. Yeah, no, there's like stuff I'm moving around. I can't help it.
It's okay.
If you haven't heard a lot of Ellen this episode, it's because she is at work, everybody.
Yeah.
I can't not do it.
We appreciate you for it. So we need to do that. We were talking about making another copy because like we've made some changes to like some of the words and phrases.
The last time we printed the materials, the game was quite a bit, well, not quite a bit different, but different enough now.
That it could use a, yep. It could use a polish. Mark, you had that a lot of the work that you did this weekend was coming up with a list of things we would want for the future copy of the game, right?
For the next printed prototype, yeah. Because it was, I wouldn't say that expensive, but the fact that it's going to then go into the garbage soon, it means that like the next time we do it, I want to make sure we're not printing a new copy. Because we get them from a company called The Game Crafter, which will do custom decks and stuff like that. That was a big part of when we first started testing this printed version is... I really, really wanted it to not be, cut out office paper, because as much as that's a storied tradition, I think that impacts the playtesting process more than I think most board game designers believe. Mm. I might be wrong, but it's my belief that, like, the physicality of a board game is so important that it is very hard for players to, when they just have the generic materials and the aerial printed on office paper components to not think of themselves as play testers when they should be thinking of themselves as players.
Sure.
And so that was important to me, but now we need a new version, and but you can't do that with every tweak.
Right.
Because it's way too expensive.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But we're at the point now where like this is going to be what it is until a publisher makes its version.
Yeah.
And, you know, presumably I would like to think it'd be close to what we make, but, you know, we're going to, that's a conversation to have with whoever wants to buy the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking about the updates to icons, clarity in how things, based on all the feedback we've collected over a bunch of playtests, including last night's, updating the terminology that we've settled on this weekend. And thinking about, we're talking about the reference card, which would, which was an important thing to sort of clarify rules. That was a big thing we learned. The sort of like what needs to be easy access for players and what should they go to the rule book for.
Yeah.
And so that's going to be a big part of it. Whereas, we didn't really have a good, setup for that in the previous prototypes.
Right.
That was a big part. That was the admin work I was doing, is putting us a to-do list that, I don't know, I'll get to sometime.
Yeah. And I mean, well, there's all these new, one thing that's interesting is like, I did make all of these new objectives, right?
Yeah.
But I'm wondering if like, even the game needs like more than just standard objectives, and like, because I feel like I'm not positive on this because I'm not really a board game developer, especially not one for like hardcore board game players. But I feel like games come out with expansions already out of like available from jump.
Oh,
which is weird.
You want to sell another box?
I mean, maybe.
I mean, it's a deck of cards, so like as an expansion, it has a physical, you know, utility to it.
Right. And so
it's
like
not
we
extra
could,
pieces.
Yeah, we could sell different sizes. The ones that like I designed, we could sell those as different sizes, potentially. Because I think that I feel like even just if you only had one objective in the game, you still get a decent amount of variety because like the project leader swaps between everyone and you will get different roles.
Yeah.
And so I think that like, even though mechanically you'll be rolling the die for the same reasons, like there's still a lot of the actual play still changes quite a decent amount, I think.
Yeah, is this a game that needs like those different categories? And a lot of it is because we haven't play tested anything but the sort of standard ones, and we've been satisfied with it.
Yes.
Even though we always wanted the three types, we're satisfied not having them. And you're the one who did the work on these.
Right.
And even you are like, I don't know that we need them.
Yeah.
That's saying something. But I think we need to test them.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not suggesting we don't test them. That would be blasphemy.
No, of course. But I mean, I think we will then either fall in love with it.
Yeah.
Or we'll be like, oh, yeah, we'll just put this in a drawer and it will be a pitch for future expansions.
Yeah, that's fine, too.
I think definitely we want people to play the standard ones as their first experience.
Yes.
And which gives you some freedom as designing the shorter and longer ones to sort of assume the players understand the dynamic a little better.
Right.
Which is nice. True. They could be more interesting or complicated or a little bit, you could take some risks with player understanding.
That's part of why I was thinking of it as if it is an expansion, then like you can assume the players have played the game at least one time.
Yeah.
Right. And then they've they can go into these shorter ones or these longer ones, knowing a little bit about how the game,
you know, what the implications are. Yeah,
right. Yeah, we can, you know, we can think about, even if we don't think of it as a DLC strategy, as an expansion.
I do that every time too.
We're video game people.
Yeah.
Thinking about right now, we have the three categories.
Yep.
And there's emergency, standard, and epic.
Yes.
And standard is a boring word, and we were like, do we have a fun word for that? And, you know, so, but maybe it's just we have objectives, and then we have emergency objectives and epic objectives.
Oh, sure.
You know what I mean? To make it feel a little bit more expansion-y.
Yeah.
When you, even if it was in the box.
Yeah.
So that players understand that those are extra.
Oh, that's a good idea.
You know what I mean? Get that mindset independent of whether we sell it separately or not.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a fun idea. I like that idea. That's a good. Yeah. Cause of the sizing where, I mean, I don't know about how you feel about it, Mark, but I'm not sold on the specific wording of the sizing, the different sizes. Of
I think,
the two.
I mean, we may end up with it, but we haven't decided to, cause we haven't done a lot of brainstorming on what else to call it.
I have been sort of theming them around that idea. Like epic ones just take longer because they require more preparation.
Yeah.
And then the emergency ones are shorter because you have less time to do things.
I think the reason we went with that is to really move away from the implication that the shorter ones are easier and the longer ones are harder.
Yeah.
But there are other terms that might do a better job.
Yeah, potentially. Yeah. We could talk about that too. That's one of the things we'll do in the future.
Yeah. Well, before this turns into a whole other bit of robust and brainstorming, I think, unless there's anything else, I think we can set this aside until we do another Robustin special, because we've kind of done a couple of them. Mm-hmm. Every now and again, when we work on this, we want to do an episode about it. So this probably will not be the last you hear about.
Well, we've done it for a few games. We did it for Dogpile and Glom as well. So, you know, this one just takes longer to make.
Yeah. Well, we could probably put it's a whole mini series. We've probably done like 6 Robustin episodes.
Oh, yeah. We've done a few.
Yeah. And there's a whole bunch
over the years.
There's a whole bunch of working content in Patreon, too, that you could check out if you'd like.
Ooh, stealth pitch. I love it. Patreon.com/nicegamesclub. You want to hear hours and hours of us designing Robustin.
Yeah. Yeah, it is hours and hours. It's a lot of work put into it.
And don't let Steven's like a tone fool you. It's cool to listen to.
It is.
No, you guys need to keep going. I have more rules to write.
Don't end the show.
Keep talking. That's our show. As usual, we will post some show notes on our website, nicegames.club. We will post some links to previous episodes and some pictures from playtesting last night. Visit us on social media at Nice Games Club, where Dale posts about game dev resources and coding, how it's like a pendulum. Reply on the various platforms or email us, contact@nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff. We talked about this earlier. Ad-free episodes and cool content. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello.
So, until we start again, back in Minneapolis, remember to
play nice
and make nice. Trying to decide what we'd even post for show notes on this. Pictures of Duluth?
At your job, do you ever have to deal with a nose roller? How about a snub pulley? Well, if you're installing a new conveyor belt system, dealing with the different components can sound like you're speaking a foreign language. Luckily, you've got a team ready to help. Grainger's technical product specialists are fluent in maintenance, repair, and operations. So whenever you want to talk shop, just reach out. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
At Kroger Pharmacy, Care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.